CES for me is always like some sort of weird combination of Sid toys from Toy Story and the end of Blade Runner, right?
I think one of the wildest gadget was this lollipop star, which kind of this bone conduction lollipop that plays music through your teeth.
Let me tell you, there is nothing more terrifying than watching an AI agent basically do your job. A question for Chris. Is 2026 the year of the AI agent?
No, 2026 is the year of the super agent.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the smartest minds in technology to distill down what's important in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists. We've got Chris Hay, distinguished engineer, Katar El-Megrawi, principal research scientist, and Martin Keane, master inventor. Welcome to you all, and happy 2026. We've got a big episode today, as always. We're going to talk a little bit about Meta's Manus acquisition. We're going to talk about this new paper out of DeepSeek focusing on model scaling. And we're going to end with a super interesting little report that came out polling Americans on their views around AI. But first, of course, the big event of the week is CES. I obviously want to talk about the gadgets. There's a bunch of really fun things going on in AI and gadgetry, but I would be remiss if we didn't focus first on Jensen's keynote. NVIDIA has announced NVIDIA Rubin, which is their new platform. As per usual, I think, again, we've been a little bit desensitized to how quickly things are moving, but even with this announcement, I was a little shocked. So what Jensen is promising for NVIDIA Rubin is a platform that's five times more powerful than Blackwell. And basically, they're claiming a reduction of token cost for inference by about 10x, which would really change a lot of what we know about how the economics of this space work. Chris, do you want to talk about what your hot take on Rubin is?
I mean, I think that obviously the chips are going to get better and better because at the end of the day, you know, everybody's using NVIDIA for their training. And actually, in some regards, with competition coming in from inference, although I have to say that some of that competition is gone now that they've bought Grok there, they want to be able to keep folks on NVIDIA chips. So actually, probably the thing that's most stunning to me there and not surprising is that they are focusing a little bit on the inference side of things over the training. Of course, there's a massive effect on training there as well, but that sort of change in focus onto inference probably makes sense, especially with more and more of the frontier labs going towards TPUs and going with Google there. I think it was sort of inevitable that Jensen was going to come out with a faster chip with five times the speed of inference. So yeah, great to hear. It's great for AI, but I'm not that surprised.
Yeah, I think it's sort of interesting thinking about this on the backdrop of all the other competition that they've seen pop up over the last year or so. Kautar, I know you're in this space day in, day out. Were you surprised by how far ahead Rubin is, or is this kind of, you know, par for the course of what we expect from NVIDIA at this point?
Yeah, I wasn't actually surprised. I think it's, like you said, part of the course. Of course, there's
a
lot of
focus. Why wasn't it 10x, you know, more powerful than Blackwell?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, this is something that they've been working on, especially on the inference side. So, you know, to get to where they want to go with especially the large multimodals, you know, the robots and so on. So, you know, that efficiency becomes super important. And, you know, Jensen here is betting that AI's next home isn't a chatbot, but a robot. And in, you know, in this year, the year, you know, we finally stop talking about LLMs and you really start talking about LMMs, like these large multi-models that move. So I think it's an interesting shift here. And, you know, if you look at NVIDIA versus the world, you know, with the government taking like 10% stake in Intel and AMD, you know, releasing these world's fastest gaming chip like Ryzen 7, etc., is NVIDIA's hardware more finally being threatened? Or, you know, does, you know, Vera Rubin here move, you know, the goalposts too far? So I think it's interesting dynamics to see here playing. But I think what NVIDIA did is set the tone for the year ahead with this bold claim that AI isn't just a technology domain anymore, is also shaping every aspect of computing. And, you know, I think the Rubin platform, NVIDIA's, you know, next extreme, this co-designed AI infrastructure that promises to cut, you know, the cost of AI inference dramatically. This isn't just about your neural performance by reducing, you know, the tokens cost that you mentioned. I think NVIDIA here is trying to make large AI workloads also affordable and deployable at massive scale.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just like really interesting to see them put kind of like the flag in the ground. I guess, Martin, do you have any responses to kind of how far ahead NVIDIA is here? Like, I actually don't really have a good sense of like, you know, does this mean that like the TPUs are never going to catch up? Like, you know, AMD is never going to catch up. I guess what Kauto is kind of saying is like, while they might ultimately catch up on GPUs, maybe NVIDIA is just like such a broad spectrum company at this point that's really hard to see anyone catching up.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm more easily impressed. I was kind of blown away with the numbers for this Rubin GPU.
Not these cynics on the panel.
But yeah, I mean, what I thought was particularly interesting about this is that this is not something that's available. Like, you can't go and get these chips anytime soon. They're talking about second half of, you know, of the year. So we're at least 6 months out. So it really is, like you say, Tim, kind of a stake in the ground to say that this is what is coming. And I think that is very interesting when you consider that perhaps the model that's doing best on benchmarks right now is probably the latest Gemini model. And that doesn't use any NVIDIA chips in its training. So I think it was important for NVIDIA to really come out and say, look, here's what we've got, that, you know, TPUs aren't everything. We have our own platform here that is, you know, continuing to get a lot faster. It's going to be able to really do a lot. And by putting that stake in the ground now and saying, you know, this is what's coming, I think that is going to affect how future models are developed with that, those sort of savings in mind now, because you can start to think that, yeah, some of these workloads that would seem unaffordable, that they would not be economically viable on the current chips today on the Blackwell architecture, perhaps will be later in this year.
You know what makes me happiest of all about the NVIDIA announcement, Tim? It means that I can say whatever I want this episode about agents. I can say whatever opinion I want. Nobody is going to bat an eyelid in the comment section because they're all going to focus on Tim's pronunciation of NVIDIA throughout NVIDIA. This video. So that's what. So I can say whatever I want at this point. Nobody's going to care. I can be like, we're going to have super mega triple agents. And
I mean,
you know,
go for it, Chris. Go for it.
This is going to be the decade of the agents, and AI is going to, you know, make $1 trillion for everybody this month alone. And nobody's going to bat an eyelid because we opened with NVIDIA. That's yes. What I love.
That's what you love. Well, it's all for you, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, we should move on to, actually, the other parts of CES, because obviously CES is not just NVIDIA. I think the one fun part about CES is always the gadgets, right? I think what's really exciting is sort of seeing how much experimentation there's going on in the space. And so I guess, Kautar, I know you were pretty excited by some of the things that you saw in terms of the devices that people were touting at this year's CES.
Yeah, I really liked, you know, the Roborock Saros rover, which is this vacuum with high legs to climb stairs. I mean, I have, you know, these robots. I have like maybe like 4 or 5 robots in my house, each one of them or for, you know, different section or. So I like this, you know, one robot that can navigate, you know, your house, climb up the stairs, even clean the stairs. So, but I'm not sure when that's going to be available. I think one of the wildest gadget was this lollipop star, which kind of this bone conduction lollipop that plays music through your teeth. I found that really pretty wild and very weird. So there were some interesting gadgets. I think also the Samsung Galaxy, the trifold screen, that I think was really cool.
Yeah, for sure. Martin, you had a couple picks as well that you'd focus to have our listeners check out.
Yeah, I love these things at CES because some of them are just so incredible from a technology point of view. And you will never see them in real life ever. So
it's like a parallel universe that is CES.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I particularly enjoyed the rollable screen laptops where you could just kind of rub your finger across the top of the screen and it would go from like a 13-inch display to a 16-inch display. I'm not sure why you wouldn't just always want it as 16-inch, but, you know, it was kind of cool that you could do that. But yeah, I love these vacuum robots too. Like, that is one of the examples of a technology that actually people do have in their houses. And just how far they've come over the last few years. I mean, I got one of the first Roombas when it came out, and you had to charge it yourself. You had to empty its bin itself. It was like more work to manage that thing than it would save you in vacuuming time. And now, of course, they all can charge themselves. They go to their own docks to clean it out. But yeah, that stairs thing is really the last hurdle. So the fact that this thing could basically sprout legs and climb up the stairs and clean the stairs as it went as well. Fantastic. I've got to get one of those.
Nice. Chris, what do you got?
I mean, CES for me is always like some sort of weird combination of Sid toys from Toy Story and the end of Blade Runner, right? And it's all like, here's a doll with a roller blade attached to its head driving around or whatever. And you just look at it and go, oh my goodness, what is going on here? But on a serious point, I like the innovation. For me, it's got to be the Lego Smart Brick. I think that's what I want to be playing with. I'm going to have some fun with that.
And I think one thing maybe I want to add, maybe there is also this AI fatigue that I see a lot of, you know, the gadgets. You know, it was, you know, I think AI was the centerpiece of the consumer and the enterprise technology that was shown nearly every product category, from TVs, appliances, robots, vehicles, etc., advertised some form of AI capability. But so I think maybe consumers here are overwhelmed by features, maybe without also clear value. And also, one thing I noticed, maybe this is my take, that many of these AI gadgets, they try to solve the UX problems poorly, not really intelligence problems. And also, it is also showing that CES is no longer about invention, but it's about integration maturity. The real story here is not what was shown, but what did not also change. That, you know, the same constraints around memory, bandwidth, latency, energy efficiency, reliability, and so on, I think they're still there.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like that. I agree with you, Kautar, is like sort of in the midst of all this craziness, there's actually some really important stuff kind of going on underneath about how these devices are going to fit into our lives.
I think edge AI, I think it also still lacks some, you know, strong guarantees, especially around privacy, determinisms, and also the offline behavior. So, and I think that's going to be really especially important for the next wave of these consumer AI. I think it will come from predictability more than maybe novelty, because there's a lot of novelty that we've seen already. But having a predictable behavior, reliable behavior, I think that's going to be also become very key.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic. There's a lot to cover today. So this happened right at the end of last year. Meta announced another mega acquisition of Singapore-based Agents Lab Manus for $2 billion. And this caps off, obviously, a year in which Meta was spending a lot of money to acquire talent, really getting into the acquisitions game. I guess maybe, Martin, I'll kick it over to you. Why does this acquisition make sense for a company like Meta?
Well, it gives them something that they don't already have, which is a really powerful agentic AI platform that can just do a whole lot of work for you. So I'd not used Manus AI, and then when this announcement came out, I was kind of curious as to what it could do.
Like, I should check it out now.
So I went on and I just like sent it a task. I mean, the basic idea of this thing is it's kind of an autonomous multi-agent system, and it can run within its own kind of computer effectively. It's an Ubuntu workstation has access to. So I just said, create me a presentation that will teach me what Manus AI is from a technical perspective. And you can watch it work. So as it's doing this task, it's basically going out and it's running a web browser, and you can watch it go, you know, move its mouse and navigate through websites. And then it was performing some editing with Markdown text. So it was like making notes of what it would see in Markdown. You can see it kind of typing into the editor. And then it would fire up a Linux terminal and it would start running commands to create a PowerPoint chart. And the output of this was like this beautifully formatted PowerPoint chart that explained what Manus was, created by Manus, and also a load of supporting documentation as well. Like, you know, here's the research it came up with, here's the summary and stuff like that. Let me tell you, there is nothing more terrifying than watching an AI agent basically do your job, which is what it was doing here. Because my job is technical education. I learn about a technology, I create a series of charts about that technology so I can teach other people about it.
Right. And it's like I'm you could feel the icy hand of AGI on your shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. It's just doing my job, but way, uh-huh. way faster. So I could absolutely see the value in this of being able to, you know, take these AI models, and it's using a series of different AI models there. Although interestingly, I think most of it's based on Claude, so not really a meta model. But it's going through and basically using these models through this agentic platform and running on its own workstation and coming up with a pretty good output as a work product. So I can totally see the attraction to Meta and getting into that, as terrifying as it was for me to watch it run.
What is Meta trying to achieve in terms of a business, right? Is it, you know, ultimately an agent will go out to social media and be on the Facebook platform for you or the Instagram platform for you? Is it they want to do enterprise sales at some point with these like agent technologies? It's interesting because Manus is clearly a really cool capability. But I think the thing I'm always still struggling with is like how it fits into Meta's overall business strategy.
So the thing I find really interesting when we looked at the acquisition statement and is that it seemed to be they were buying Manus for their internal productivity capabilities. And that seemed to be the focus on the announcement, which I thought was really interesting because if you remember, Tim, we were talking over New Year, which was, you know, the advent of the super agent. And in fact, Manus being the thing that, you know, is a great representation of just one agent that can go and do everything for you. Although underneath the hood is a multi-agent orchestration. And Martin described that beautifully. So actually, in some regards, Manus could be a bit of a front door for their platform so that you can have agentic AI. But they seem to be focusing that on their internal productivity more than anything. And if I'm honest, I think that's pretty smart, starting with internal productivity, because the more costs that you can save internally, the faster that you can get to market, the more that you can achieve with your internal work means that you can funnel that money back into and that speed and agility into getting your product out quicker and doing more innovative things. So there is always a temptation to say, I've got to own that front door, but actually they're trying to sort out their back door at the moment. And I don't think that's such a bad thing, but I think they are sitting on a bit of a gold mine there, and I do think that super agent market is there for the taking, and I think Manus is actually quite a good acquisition. So maybe that will pivot in time, and you know what? As I said, I'm not worried about saying super agent or the year of the agent because the comment section is not going to be focusing on what I'm saying today.
You sound a little bitter, Chris.
No, I'm
Katar. Katar, do you buy that as kind of like part of this is just its internal productivity, which is a wild thing to say, right? But could very well be the case.
I think part, yes, that is true. But I also think, you know, this pivot to agents, it's also, you know, kind of meta signaling that talking to AI is over. It's like an era that is, we're beyond that. And doing with AI is here. And this is moving Meta from a social ad company to an enterprise software powerhouse. And so, you know, there's also talent wars here. So Meta also bought on scale AI's Alexander Wark to lead their AI efforts. So does this consolidate too much power into, you know, Menlo Park? So I think, you know, this is, I think, a cornerstone of Meta's 2026 strategy is this $2 billion acquisition of Manus AI. And I think really it's marking this shift from conversational chatbots to AI agents that can really perform real work. And I think what Manus, you know, showed, you know, they basically hit $125 million in revenue in just 8 months, which is proving that enterprises are willing to pay for AI that actually does things. I think they're also betting on this wearable super intelligence, so which is, you know, kind of the primary way that we interact with AI won't be through a phone, but through our eyes and ears. So this is, I think, also one of their, you know, a big piece in their strategy is, you know, these smart glasses over smartphones and these neural interfaces, which is kind of changing the way we interact with AI.
Yeah, I think that's actually it's a good point that I had sort of forgotten. Meta had, I remember, taken a lot of criticism when they were transitioning to Meta and really pushing the metaverse. There was a little demo video they released of like someone using the metaverse, but it wasn't for gaming. It was basically for like taking video conferences and doing calls, like as if you were working at a company. And a lot of people said like, oh, that's so funny. Like, why would you do that? But it's a good reminder that Meta has always had maybe like this idea that they would get into the enterprise market, right? Be a platform that you use for business. And maybe this is in some ways like another attempt at like getting into that space. Next topic I want to move us on to is a paper that DeepSeek dropped. And this is a fun one because I think it gives us a chance to talk about what's happening in model architectures. So I'll give you kind of the quick summary. DeepSeek is basically proposing a kind of architecture that they call manifold constrained hyperconnections, or MHC. And it's essentially considered an improvement over the original sort of HC design that was proposed by ByteDance back in 2024. And so that's like a lot of jargon if you're not really following, you know, the papers very closely. I think kind of what's interesting, though, where I want to start with this discussion, and maybe, Chris, you'd be the best person to kick this over to, is do you want to talk a little bit about what ResNet is? And then I think with that foundation, it's sort of interesting then talking about what's happening with HC.
Okay, so if we think about the transformer architecture for a second and why DeepSeek is super interested in this, the cost of training is absolutely huge. And if you remember, they are quite constrained on the GPUs and they need to be able to do that as cheap as possible. When we look at a sort of standard transformer architecture, really what is happening is you have a single stream which the model is essentially looking at. So when you're training a model, for example, you have all this embedding information and it's literally going through the layers. And this information, you know, from your prompt all the way through, is just traveling through this layers as a stream. Now, if you think about what's going on there, that means that as you go through the layers, a bunch of the information gets modeled up, et cetera, and they all end up on this one big stream. What they are doing in this sense to be able to improve the training is they're parallelizing the stream. So that means there are multiple lanes in this and the data is splitting up and then moving through the layers. Now that obviously makes it more efficient, which is great, because then that means that they're going to have cheaper costs. So remember what I said about GPU constrained and the cost of training large models, they're trying to bring the cost of training models down. However, the problem that you have there when you're training models is the fact that the model can, you know, basically, if you get a sort of a weak signal, it can amplify and amplify and amplify and then effectively ruin your training run. So, and that's basically known as either the exploding or the vanishing problem. So what you're really trying to do on the training is if something, you want to be able to constrain things a bit so that, you know, if one signal doesn't end up amplifying and blowing your training run. And that's really what the manifolds are doing in that sense of this piece. So it's essentially stabilizing that. It's bringing it all together so no individual signal is going to blow up your training run. And therefore, you get a smoother run, and therefore, it keeps the training on track, and then it's not going to cost you a lot of money. So what they're aiming for is basically cheaper training, right, and more kind of you know, stable training at that point. And that's really the focus there. And they've achieved that, right? Based on the paper, they've done a pretty good job there. So I think a lot of people are going to be taking on that architecture going forward. And what that means for the industry, and I think it's good, is that other people are going to start utilizing these techniques, and the cost of model training and the cost of hopefully down to us, being able to fine-tune will become cheaper and more relevant and therefore make it more accessible for everybody else.
This is, I mean, a good thing, of course. I think, Kautar, I want to bring in a little bit of the hardware story to some of this. What I mean by that is, I remember I think we had a conversation almost maybe summer last year where we were talking a little bit about this race that's been happening, where it's basically like, how cheap will compute come and can you just keep buying more and more of it? How quickly can you lower the cost of training and make that like the way that you get to what you want to do? You know, both are happening in some ways, right? Like you have NVIDIA launching all of its new platforms at the same time that you have all of these model innovations happening. And I guess the question for you is like, are you more or less optimistic about one side of this equation or the other? Or does it really kind of feel like both are kind of like moving just very, very rapidly?
I think it has to be a really deep co-design, you know, model architectures improving, you know, underlying systems improving, but, you know, this extreme hardware software co-design, you know, has, you know, to continue. And I think what, you know, DeepSeek here did with their this new algorithm, they did not, you know, eliminate the scaling laws. They're just reframing them as an efficiency and architecture problem. So the interesting takes here is scaling is shifting from parameter count to data efficiency. You know, how, you know, like Chris mentioned, how the information is flowing inside the model instead of having, you know, these like chains, you're having these layers, you know, these hyperfolds, you know, hyper connections in a more efficient way. You know, instead of having these random things, you know, like these connections grow randomly, you're doing it in a more controlled way. So the optimizations here often pushes, you know, complexity downstream into the systems. And, you know, this approach that they're proposing, it favors data flow and custom accelerators. So, you know, I think we often talk about, you know, the data flow architectures versus, you know, the way, you know, the data parallel architectures and so on. So, for example, if you look at, you know, some of the accelerators that we're developing at IBM Research, like the AIU, it's a data flow architecture, which is much more suitable for LLMs and for these, because, you know, the data flow is much more efficient than just, you know, focusing on the compute intensive, you know, with these dense models. So the future of scaling here may be architectural and system level, not just purely mathematical. You know, as these AI models get bigger, they usually, you know, get better, but also much more expensive and harder to train. You know, the training stability becomes a problem. So today's approach to improving AI mostly relies on brute force, adding these, you know, more data, more compute power, more parameters. And that's what traditional scaling laws, you know, that OpenAI and others have shown, that works, but it's increasingly inefficient and only affordable by a few large companies. So I think, you know, the idea, for example, that DeepSeek is showing, this manifold constraint hyperconnections, is more about scaling AI more intelligently rather than just making it bigger. And we need more of that. So it's a smarter way of, you know, designing these models that would work better for the hardware. So I think it's very smart move. And I think for, you know, for systems and hardware, this results in better utilizations of compute, fewer wasted training steps, enables also these data-friendly architectures, and really plays well with these custom accelerators. So, and of course, this can result in more performance per flop, less brute force scaling, and also lower energy cost per capability unit. So this has really huge implications on the efficiency and also works much nicely with the custom accelerators.
Yeah, and Carlo, just to add to that as well, if we think about the signal as well, as I said earlier, everything's kind of getting munched up at the moment. So with them improving the architecture, I mean, you know, and separating out in the parallel stream, there's opportunity for that signal to be clearer in certain areas. Now, if we look at some of the models and how they're going, to Kadar's point, right, everything is kind of like brute forcing everything. And really the architectural changes of the future should be more about sculpting, right? So if we start to thinking about kind of the chain of thought and things like that, it actually creates more of an AI pipeline structure within the models. And the layers become more structured as opposed to a mess of everything. And why that becomes important then with MHC there is that you can start to separate out some of that signal into, theoretically, into their own stream. So if you're just wanting to monitor one part, so maybe you want to route a token, do some sort of classification in a token, and then route that across to a circuit, that's going to be easier to observe because it's going to be easier to split that out necessarily from the rest of the signal, which is all sort of munched together. So as Kaudar was saying there, I think we're going to move into this era of where, rather than everything being a big blobby parameter mess, everything starts to sculpt out a little bit and we start to see AI pipelines and circuits, and it's going to be more interpretable. And I think actually architecturally, this is probably a good way of doing this. And I see more architectural innovations coming in that space.
Yeah, it's kind of a shift to design intelligence, right? So, and I like actually this analogy of maybe like, it's like upgrading a city's roads network, not by adding random roads everywhere, by designing kind of a structured highway system that really scales much more smoothly.
Listening to Chris and Kautva here, I mean, it's making me think, should all labs emulate DeepSync by basically like throwing away their most high-powered GPUs and then, you know, making themselves artificially constrained so that they come up with all of these clever things like manifold constrained hyperconnections? Because, I mean, when DeepSeek came along with R1, you know, that's a model that should never have been as good as it was considering how it was trained. And it just kind of is forcing people to be able to make the most of the harbor that they've got by coming up with clever architectures and so forth. So it seems like, yeah, one solution to that would be to just, you know, like chop off half of your compute capacity and put the same engineers in the same tasks and tell them, now what?
This does get to a question I wanted to ask Chris, which is, yeah, I think I could tell you a story about how DeepSeek is really constrained in certain ways, so they've had to be really innovative. And I guess, Chris, you also had that comment about like, oh, it's going to become more like sculpting because not everything is going to be a big parameter mess. I guess question for you, Chris, as someone who's really close to this is, do you feel like the skills that will be necessary for designing good models is going to change with time? Because it feels like we're talking about a pretty different way of thinking about these problems than, you know, really how we've done it for like the last few years.
I think so. I think, I honestly spent all of Christmas just playing with training models and mechanistic interpretability, really trying to understand the models. And I think there are three skills that are going to emerge more than anything. And I think Anthropic is probably living some of this as well. The first one is neuroscientists, right? Because actually the mapping of the models is, if you really think about it, it's a set of neurons, and certain neurons will perform certain tasks. So if I go to like Function Gemma was one of the models that was released during the week. There is an individual neuron where if I poke that neuron, then it will switch on and off tool calling. It's literally that much. And then similarly in like if I take GPT OSS models, if I steer a particular set of neurons, I can switch it from being a plus mathematical operation to a multiplication, right? Just by steering the neurons. That is neuroscience. And again, if you look at what Anthropic's doing, they have a whole bunch of biologists and neuroscientists going and working on in their mechanistic interpretability team. That is, it's not a computer science skill there, right? I think the second thing is, in order to sculpt those models, data pipelines become really important. It's not pre-train in some regard is still, you know, just go and train everything. But those fine-tuning is things like reward modeling. What's reward modeling? That's game theory, right? The pipelines, I need to feed this after this after this. I want this to be on this layer. That is pure engineering and sculpting of pipelines. So I think those become back to being engineering problems as well as sort of data science. And then I think the third one, which I think is the most interesting, along with the game theory, is the economics and the psychology elements of this, right? What is the model going to do in different scenarios? So I think there's a whole set of skills that are beyond traditional kind of compute skills or data science skills to be able to train these models. And I love it. It's super interesting.
This is really true in this interdisciplinary here that's combining multiple sciences and fields and so on to solve these amazing problems.
I'm going to kind of bring us to a landing here with our final topic of the day. This is sort of an interesting little report that got released. David Shore, who's mostly known as a political pollster, his firm Blue Rose Research released their poll, which was one of the largest and most recent ones to my knowledge, basically asking Americans how they felt about AI. And I thought it was very revealing because I think it definitely disrupted or I would say contradicted some of my sort of assumptions and priors about the space. I think the note that I want to begin with is one of their top line results is that when you poll Americans, optimism around AI still beats pessimism around AI by about 5%. And this is really intriguing. I mean, I think like if you talk to a lot of people, you know, I would have told you, well, there's just so much fear and, you know, concern around AI. It is kind of interesting to learn. And Martin, I don't know if this surprised you, that like it actually turns out that while, you know, people are divided, the optimists are still, you know, a little ahead of the pessimists when it comes to the technology.
Yeah, I think it seems from the numbers like this survey here and others that people are optimistic about what it can do, but also a little bit fearful of potentially what it can do. I mean, I was looking at some other numbers that YouGov published last month where they were asking questions about AI. And one of them was 5% of the people in the survey said that they would trust AI a lot, whereas 41% said that they distrusted it. So while we can see the benefits of it, and it's just been so widely adopted at a consumer level, I think there's a certain lack of trust. The number that caught my attention the most in the YouGov survey that I looked at said that 77% said that they are concerned that AI could pose a threat to humanity. And I'm kind of thinking back, like, what other technology can we say that three quarters of respondents said that actually this poses a threat to humanity. So while we are optimistic about what it can do, I think there's a lot of fear around it as well.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most interesting things coming out of the numbers, actually, is sort of like this disconnect where it's like, we all know ChatGPT, we all know Claude, they're really helpful. I love it, right? And then like people start to think more about the technology as a whole, and then the picture changes. And so I guess, Katsura, maybe the question for you is it possible for us to like, for it to be both, I guess, right? That like, actually people are extremely excited about the technology and happy about the technology, the optimists about it, but also be like pessimists simultaneously.
Yeah, I think we're humans. There's always a part of us that gets excited and love what we're seeing and all the results, but also a part of us, you know, that's fearful. And but also some of the interesting things that I saw in the polls and these surveys, it's also not whether people like it or not, but also who benefits, you know, if AI replaces human labor. And, you know, the answer was interesting, you know, across almost every demographic, which I found very interesting. People wanted shared ownership. So, which tells me here that the public already understands something policymakers are avoiding, that productivity without ownership leads to instability. And why this is powerful, you know, this is kind of elevating the discussion beyond the AI panic, but kind of showing more public sophistication here is like, when AI takes my job, am I still going to have control or not? So I think those are real questions that we need to start asking ourselves. You know, what's going to happen to us, you know, as humans? What are we going to do? What control do we have? And those are really profound questions that, you know, societal, you know, it has a lot of implications here. And I think that I thought that was really interesting in this, you know, this kind of post-labor question, a world where most people don't have traditional jobs. And the dominant response isn't to stop AI, it's kind of change the economics contract here. And that's a very interesting insight here.
Yeah, I mean, looking at that Blue Rose research report, it was interesting because it was you know, much like a political report, it's all based on age or who you voted for and stuff like that. And for once, every demographic seemed to agree. We all kind of came to the same agreement there, that it would be kind of dangerous for private companies just to have access to AI, that it's something that we should all own equally. Like, finally, we've got agreement on something.
Yeah, so this is the true bipartisan uniting issue in American politics. Chris, do you want to jump in? And then I have a specific question for you. So
I don't trust the questioning at all. You basically said to people, do you want to own a bit of that, you know, all these trillion-dollar companies? And everybody went, oh, yeah, I would like that. I think you could have said, do you want free lollipops? And they would have went, yeah, I like lollipops. I'll have that as well. Do you know what I mean? I don't trust the question. You know what I mean? It's of course, they're going to say, who's going to turn around in that question and go, no, I don't want it. I think the private companies should have full access to that. That's what should happen. Of course, everybody's going to say, I want a piece of the pie. Come on.
But also, it's like, also, it's the question around who this AI is working for. Is it working for us or working for these private companies? You know, what share do we have? The answer is not surprising. Like Chris said, everybody wants a piece of it. But I think there are deeper implications, you know, than just what we see here. So how is this going to impact us?
Yeah, I guess, Chris, the question for you as someone who I think is a real booster of the technology, you're ultimately at the end of the day an optimist for this stuff, is whether or not you feel like, how seriously should we take the pessimism, right? Like, is there going to be a huge backlash against AI this year that, you know, severely limits what we can do with AI? That's like, you know, some people are talking about that. I don't know if you take that seriously, though.
I think it's all to do with controls. Here's my question. Would you open up your local nuclear plant to the average American and say, come into my nuclear power plant tour. By the way, you can press whatever buttons you like. And you would probably go, no, because you know somebody will go, ooh, I'm going to hit the meltdown button, and then it calls a meltdown. And it's just inevitable, because that's what people do. They're just going to press buttons. They don't know what it does. And I think in the same way is like, I'm not sure I would be putting an AI in, you know, if I put 1,000 AIs in front of that, one of them's going to press the button, right? And It's about control, right? And it's the same if you take any industry, for example. If you go to something like a contact center or whatever, I'm making this up there, you have a set of people who have VIP account celebrities, right? And therefore, only certain people can access those accounts. Because guess what? You don't want your average person going in and going, I wonder what Brad Pitt's address is. What's his phone number? I'll go and give him a phone call. Not going to happen, right? You have to put controls there. So I think if you're giving unfettered access to AI to the entire world and you're handing over control and orchestration, that's not AI's problem. That's your problem in the first place. And I think that is how we should be looking at this. It's like there is governance and there's control that you need to put in place. But in certain scenarios, it's okay for AI to go running around. Now, of course, there's a bigger question where when AI gets smarter than us, is it just going to go, Chris is wrong. I'm just going to go and do what I was going to do anyway. That's the bigger question. And of course, we need to, that's where we have those deeper questions where we need to figure that out. But we ain't there yet. But I think the bigger risk is where we are with today, with AI today, there is risk where if you just give unfettered access to AI, that's probably a bigger risk in the short term over superintelligence, in my opinion.
Martin, final thought of today.
Okay, I have a final thought, a question for Chris. Is 2026 the year of the AI agent?
No, 2026 is the year of the super agent.
AI super agent. All right. You heard it here first here on MOE. That's a great note to end on. And that's all the time that we have for today. Martin, Chris, Kautar, pleasure as always having you on the show. We'll see you many more times this year, I'm sure. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you on the next episode of Mixture of Experts.